Welcome to Diverse Voices Book Review. I'm Hopeton Hay. My guests today are Fry Gilyard and Cynthia Tucker, co-authors of The Southernization of America, A Story of Democracy in the Balance. The Southernization of America is a compelling series of linked essays considering the role of the South in shaping America's current political and cultural landscape. It is inspired in part It is inspired in part by a book published in 1974, The Americanization of Dixie by John Egerton. Cynthia and Fry dive deep into many issues, including the morphing of the Southern strategy of Richard Nixon and Ronald Reagan into the Republican Party of today, the death of George Floyd, and the attack on our nation's capital. Fry Gilyard is a writer in residence at the University of Southern Fry Gilyard is a writer in residence at the University of South Alabama and award-winning author of more than 20 books. Cynthia Tucker is a Pulitzer Prize-winning syndicated columnist who has spent most of her career in journalism and is currently the journalist in residence at the University of South Alabama. Fry and Cynthia, welcome to Diverse Voices Book Review.
Thank you. Thank you for having us.
So Fry and Cynthia, when did you two first actually meet? You both have been journalists for a very long time. I imagine you met long before you came together to write this book.
I think Fry and I met about a decade ago at a book gathering, a literary festival in my hometown of Monroeville, Alabama. Monroeville is the hometown of Harper Lee, who wrote, as you know, To Kill a Mockingbird. And for a few decades now, it has hosted a book festival in the spring. Lots of well-known authors attend, and that includes Fry. And that's where I met Fry first. A few years later, I moved to Mobile, Alabama, which is where I am currently. We became friends. He encouraged me and helped me get a teaching job at the University of South Alabama. And that's where we got to know each other better. And I'll let him tell you a little bit about how we got together on this undertaking.
We had been doing some programs together at the University of South Alabama, and our editor at New South Books, Randall Williams, who's a great Southern journalist and editor in his own right, reached out to me early in 2021 and asked if I had about 20,000 words in me on the topic, the Southernization of America, looking at our current political moment. And I said, yeah, I think I probably have more than that. But what if I worked together on that with my friend Cynthia Tucker, and we bring a multiracial perspective to the story, and Randall jumped at that opportunity. So that's what we did.
Let's talk a little bit about the book that you're continuing or taking the thesis of this particular book to the next level, The Americanization of Dixie. You have a quote from that book, and John Egerton is, as you write, a great Southern journalist, he was. And what you quote in the book was, he wrote, "The South and the nation are not exchanging strengths as much as they are exchanging sins. More often than not, they are sharing and spreading the worst in each other while the best languishes and withers." So when did each of you actually first read this book, and how has this book sort of shaped your Southernization of America?
I read it as soon as it came out in 1974. I'm happy to say John Egerton was a friend of mine and was just one of the great and gentle souls among Southern writers. And he hoped so much that the lessons of the civil rights movement would sink in and reshape the South, that the civil rights South would become an example for the country as a whole. But John was kind of a pessimist by nature. Sort of a cheerfully gloomy guy who also warned against what he thought were the lesser angels of our nature. And I remember thinking at the time, well, no, John, you're overstating the dangers, because look at the New South governors who've just been elected, Linwood Houlton in Virginia, a Republican, Reuben Askew in Florida, a Democrat, Jimmy Carter in Georgia, who would soon become president of the United States with Southernness at the heart of his appeal. And all three of those white Democratic or white governors, Southern governors, bipartisan, embraced the lessons of the civil rights years. So I thought John was too pessimistic. And I have since come to believe that I was dead wrong about that.
I didn't read the book when it first came out. It was probably the 80s before I got around to reading Edgerton's take on the South. And I too thought he was a bit pessimistic. I thought at the time I read the book, the South was still moving along in the right direction, that it was showing the nation what was possible from the lessons of the civil rights movement. By the time I read the book, I was living in Atlanta, and Atlanta was a model, it seemed to me, for the rest of the nation. Maynard Jackson had been mayor. He had come along not only appointing many Blacks to office, but also with his model program for bringing Black entrepreneurs into government contracts. And that was a system that quickly became replicated in many places. And Atlanta was a well-run city with a Black mayor. And so I really thought that the lessons of the civil rights movement would be the lessons that the entire nation took to heart, that this is a multiracial, pluralistic democracy, and that we are all better off when we learn to live together, when we embrace our differences, and when we not just tolerate our differences, but we respect cultural and racial differences. But like Fry, we have arrived at a different moment when it seems that many of those lessons are being tossed aside.
I have a 16-year-old daughter, and what I worry about most is preparing her to be a citizen in a society or a political environment that we're currently in, where the oppression of vote is considered okay. Racist language and racist tropes has become acceptable in some quarters in a way that it wasn't acceptable for a long time. And one of the touchstones for me is I remember talking to a friend of mine who's a writer originally from Alabama. And he told me after Obama got elected, what he told me was that he was shocked at the level of comfort some of his white peers, not writers necessarily, but in social groups, that they felt making racist remarks. And then I can recall some of the things that the way that Obama was treated at, I believe it was his first or his second address as president of the United States. And so with the election of Obama, at least that's one of the touchstones in my mind, that there seemed to be some sort of backlash against this progress moving forward. And there's some other stories, of course, that you have in your book of things that were happening, like Willie Horton, 1988 election, George H.W. Bush running against Michael Dukakis, and the Willie Horton strategy that was used to sort of really hurt the Dukakis campaign. But talk a little bit, and I'll start with you, Cynthia, then you, Fry, about were there any touchstones where your optimism, when you started to see that the nation was going along a different path?
Well, you hit it. It was the election of President Obama, which most of us, I think, originally took as a sign of the tremendous progress the nation had made. Now, there were many white pundits who were quick to embrace this notion of a post-racial America. I certainly didn't believe that, but I certainly thought that Obama's election was just a stunning and welcome symbol of how far the nation was moving along that path toward a more perfect union. As it happened, I was still working for the Atlanta Journal-Constitution, and the paper sent me to Washington, D.C. to write about the Obama presidency. So I was present for a lot of the racism to which he was subjected. The Tea Party movement arose quickly after Obama's election. And while the members claimed that their concern was all about government spending and taxes, I attended many of their rallies, and many of the signs that they held up didn't have anything to do with spending or taxes. It was the ugliest, most racist stuff, with Obama as a witch doctor, or Obama's face pasted on the body of a gorilla. I saw so much of that after the Affordable Care Act passed. The late, great John Lewis, who was still a congressman whom I knew well, and another Black Georgia congressman told me that walking down the steps of the Capitol, where a largely white crowd was gathered to protest the Affordable Care Act, they were called the N-word. I also had a white college dean whom I came to know well, a man whose politics were on the to the left of center, who was a big Obama supporter, tell me he had been shocked and saddened by the number of affluent whites, well-educated whites, who had insisted to him that Obama, in fact, wasn't born in the US, who had bought into this birtherism nonsense, which was just another way of saying that Obama was illegitimate as a president. So it was right after the, during Obama's first term, that I first began to sense that despite his election, we had not come nearly as far as I had believed, that in fact, his election had reawakened all of this dormant racism in a lot of white Americans.
Yeah, I agree with everything Cynthia just said. That was the moment of disillusionment for me, and it took me absolutely by surprise. When I was when I graduated in college from college in 1968, I had been a part of some of the crowds supporting Robert Kennedy in his run for president. And it was those rallies for Senator Kennedy were some of the most deliriously happy moments and hopeful moments that I could imagine in American politics. And then he was killed. And I did not feel the joy and the hope that I felt in that moment until President Obama's election in 2008, 40 years later. And I saw the images of Jesse Jackson weeping with joy on television. And I thought we had finally hit a plateau from which racial progress could not and would not be reversed. I thought Dr. King was right that the arc of the moral universe is long, but it bends towards justice. And then all of the things that Cynthia just described started to happen. And it was so disheartening to see white Americans, so many of them, refusing. I mean, it was fine if they wanted to object to some Obama policy. We do that in America. We object to we debate public policy. We should. It's democracy. It's how it works. But that wasn't what was going on. They were they were using the N-word. They were, as Cynthia said, carrying racist signs at rallies. They could not see this beautiful American family, the Obamas, and the grace that they brought to the White House. All of that you can only understand as racism of the most direct kind. And a few years later, I read Isabel Wilkerson's Caste, a wonderfully provocative, hard-hitting book in which she speculates that turned America's racial caste system, or at least that it turned its on its head in some ways and evoked a kind of primitive fear among way too many white Americans about what might lie ahead. And I guess that's what happened, because the birther in chief became Obama's successor in the White House. What a horrifying turn of events.
Before we get to Trump, I want to go to Newt Gingrich, because I can recall how once he was Speaker of the House, and I actually remember interviewing Jim Wright when he was Speaker of the House. I was working for a radio station called KPFT, and how Newt Gingrich brought him down. But I remember how it seemed that he encouraged, successfully transformed the Republican Party to be much more comfortable in using language to demonize Democrats, to demonize progressives, to demonize liberals. And it seemed that he took away the ability, at least up that particular era of the Congress, for discussions across the aisle without fear of retaliation by the orthodox Republicans in your party.
Absolutely. I covered a journalist at the Atlanta Journal-Constitution, I covered Newt from the earliest times of his political career. And I remember when he first ran, the very first time he was defeated, by the way, the first time he ran as a just right of center, earnest Rockefeller Republican who supported environmental causes, no Southern strategy. He lost. And so he decided to move harder to the right. But it wasn't till after he was actually in Congress that he decided that he should teach his fellow Republicans to use the most divisive language against their Democratic colleagues. Newt Gingrich is a student of warfare, and he decided that those same tactics should be brought to American politics, to the Capitol. So he actually held seminars and workshops where he taught his fellow Republicans that you use words like traitor and un-American to describe your Democratic rivals. And not only that, one of the reasons that Congress was bipartisan for so many decades was because members of Congress brought their families to Washington. They lived fairly close to each other. They saw each other at dinner parties, and they became friends. Gingrich discouraged that. He didn't want Republicans to be friendly with Democrats because they might get together and pass legislation. So he started telling these Republicans who were just getting elected, don't bring your family here. So that they would go home every weekend. They wouldn't get to know their Democratic rivals as people, as fellow Americans with whom you might disagree on policy, but they want the best for the country, just like you do. And unfortunately, while Gingrich eventually left, he left behind that legacy of hateful language. Used much more by Republicans, but a few Democrats have picked up the same strategy that you cannot possibly say anything good about your rival across the aisle, and you certainly don't get together with them to vote on legislation. Gingrich did great harm to the country.
Bill Clinton called it the politics of personal destruction. And it was interesting that Clinton and Gingrich, overlapped in time in Washington. And Clinton, whatever his personal flaws, was a president who not only understood in the broadest sense the lessons of the civil rights movement, but he also understood in the broadest sense the lessons of bipartisanship. And so I sort of thought for a while Gingrich and Clinton were the two opposite sides of Southern politics playing out in Washington, the dark side and the hopeful side. But the legacy of Gingrich has turned out to be a powerfully destructive thing. So, Hopeton, I'm glad you brought him up because, you know, he started the a habit of political discourse that has just done and continues to do immeasurable harm to the country. You just can't run a country effectively if you can't talk to people, listen to people, compromise in a principled way. I mean, we can't govern this country. It won't be a good place to live. It's inevitably multicultural. It's inevitably, there are going to be Republicans and Democrats, and there have to be politicians brave enough to try to heal that breach. And some of them are going to have to be Republicans. And, you know, that's a lonely a few people who have been willing to take up that cause.
One of the things I've seen with Trump as president is people that I consider moderate Republicans willing to accept the politics of resentment and the hatred being spewed by Trump because of the cut in taxes, because of their ability to maximize their income, because they don't want more immigrants coming across the border. And I just find it just so incredibly unsettling that, you know, people you see in social settings, different settings, who if on the surface appear to be moderate, discussing different issues, but will just literally just turn their back on, you know, what Trump is doing.
Well, imagine what Fry and I find living here in Lower Alabama, where I have gotten to know any number of whites who seem reasonable people. I'm the old mother of a 13-year-old. She has many white friends. The parents will have her over. Their daughters come to my house. They seem reasonable on every subject, except they're Trump voters. And I think it's more than just taxes. I think it gets to, again, what Isabel Wilkerson talked about in CAST. You know, Hopeton, if you watch any broadcast television these days that has TV commercials, you see all of this diversity in these commercials and on broadcast television shows as well. You see interracial couples, you see gay couples, you see biracial children, you see Asian Americans and Native Americans playing prominent roles as, you know, doctors, engineers, business owners, or in commercials sitting down eating cereal with their families. I think at some level, there is a substantial minority, I hope not a majority, but it might be a majority of whites in this country who are deeply uncomfortable with that. I think the idea that whites might lose their place at the top of the heap politically and culturally, that people of color might have more cultural influence. Hopeton, I have noticed how many Black female actors you see on TV these days with natural hair. That has been, in my view, a wonderful change in America. And it's happened just in the last two or three years. But I suspect for many white Americans, that's alarming. And so I think it's more than just taxes, Trump's policies. I think it's the fear and resentment that Isabel Wilkerson discussed so brilliantly in CAST.
Yeah, you know, I think Trump, one of the things that he's done is it's almost like he is Newt Gingrich and George Wallace rolled into one and on steroids. Gingrich advice to demonize the opposing party in Washington, D.C. is something that Trump took to its ultimate. And that George Wallace politics of resentment, politics of rage in addressing the broader society is something that Trump does all the time. Now, on the other side, you have a couple of things that give me at least some modicum of hope. One of them is that Steve Schmidt, for example, the former John McCain campaign manager who left the Republican Party, talks about a broader coalition of decency in this country. And I do think that the impulse toward decency in this country involves a sort of multiracial plurality of Americans. I don't think it involves a plurality of white Americans, unfortunately. That's the sad thing. Dr. King, in the last years of his life, concluded sadly, the majority of white Americans are racist. And I'm afraid that's true. No Democrat has won the majority of the white vote, if I recall, since Lyndon Johnson in 1964, and Johnson understood that his own support for the civil rights movement was the cause of that. So white Americans, the majority, have bought into too much of this divisiveness and all of the things that Trump represents so completely and that Newt Gingrich did. But there is a substantial minority of white Americans who realize that we're in it together with people of color. And that group of Americans is, I think, a plurality of the citizenship of this country. And so there is hope there. We saw it in Georgia in the 2020 elections. But if the game becomes more and more rigged, the political game with redistricting and voter suppression and even the ability to overturn elections, which is seems to be taking root in Republican legislatures, then democracy is in the balance, as we say in the book. And we know what to do, maybe not strategically, but morally and ethically, we know what to do. It's just a question of finding the will and the political means. And, you know, it's urgent.
Before we close, and I do want to close on a hopeful note, but I do want to bring up a name that when I saw what was happening, that immediately popped up in terms of when he ran for president, Patrick Buchanan.
Absolutely. And Buchanan is one of the figures that I began to pay attention to, particularly after President Obama was elected, because while Buchanan had been marginalized at that point by the Republican Party, he wrote a book in the 2000s called, I believe it was called The Suicide of a Great Power. I may have the title wrong, but I read the whole god-awful thing. And the thesis of the book was that America was destroying itself by letting in all of these immigrants of color because, of course, you know, they're all from the third world and they're going to destroy our culture. And I began to pay attention to that movement on the far right. Well, what was at the time a marginal movement, again, Pat Buchanan was marginalized by the Republican Party. That is now the Republican Party. And so while I too want to end on a hopeful note, I'll turn that over to Fry, because Fry is good about pointing out the glimmers of hope. I do want to say that I feel very strongly people need to pay attention. People of goodwill need to pay attention and take seriously the idea that democracy is in the balance, because I think it really is.
And Fry, before you give us that hopeful note, I tell you what I tell my daughter, my thoughts of a 16-year-old, and I have a 34 and a 32-year-old. I want my daughters to be prepared to fight because they're going to be in the political fight of their lives as citizens. They have to be prepared to march, to vote, to debate, to discuss that if you sit on the sidelines, there is no guarantee that our democracy will not turn into authoritarianism.
I think that's totally valid advice for your daughters. I have grandchildren the age of your youngest daughter, and I think they know that too. It's more urgent for a young person of color, I suppose, in terms of, well, I know in terms of their immediate self-interest and their even their immediate physical safety in the country. I mean, that was one of the horrifying things to me about the George Floyd killing murder was that it was a reminder to some of us who should have already known better about how physically dangerous it was for so many African Americans to live in our country. But it's morally dangerous, it's ethically dangerous, it's politically dangerous for all of us these days. And so where do we look for the glimmers of hope? You know, they're hard to find in some ways, but I will give you one. If you look at the results of the 2020 election in Georgia, not only did Joe Biden win that state, but Raphael Warnock and John Ossoff, the first African-American senator from Georgia, the first Jewish senator from Georgia, not only won, but campaigned together in and set that kind of example in terms of pursuing that election. And then we listen to the marvelous words of Reverend Warnock, Senator Warnock, in his maiden speech on the U.S. Senate floor, in which he talked about how he was a proud native son of Georgia and that he now held the U.S. Senate seat once held by the arch segregationist Herman Talmadge. And he said, that's why I love America. And so that America isn't gone yet. That's the thing he was reminding us. But that America is in serious jeopardy, as he also reminded us, not because that vision can't win at the polls, but because of structural changes that are being made in our democracy that may make it less a democracy or not a democracy at all. So yeah, your daughters, my grandkids, my granddaughters, my grandsons do have to be prepared to fight.
Fry Gilyard and Cynthia Tucker, co-authors of The Southernization of America, A Story of Democracy and the Balance. Thank you so much for being guests on Diverse Voices Book Review.
Thank you for having us.
Thanks, Hopeton.
Thank you for listening to this podcast edition of Diverse Voices Book Review. I'm Hopeton Hay, host and producer. The theme music is provided by Wright Productions. You can follow the show on social media. Under Facebook and Instagram, it's Diverse Voices Book Review, or Twitter under @DiverseBooksHay.